And Joe, I'm so proud to stand with you. And I do so mindful of all the heroic and ambitious women before me, whose sacrifice, determination, and resilience makes my presence here today even possible. This is a moment of real consequence for America. Everything we care about, our economy, our health, our children, the kind of country we live in, it's all on the line.
California Senator Kamala Harris today making her first appearance with Joe Biden since he named her his running mate yesterday. She is the first woman of color to run for vice president on a major party ticket. Harris built her career here in California. She was born in Oakland. She got her start in public office as the San Francisco District Attorney and then California Attorney General before winning her Senate seat in 2016. Here she is on the Senate Judiciary Committee grilling Attorney General William Barr over his handling of the Mueller report.
I think the American public has seen quite well that you are biased in this situation and you've not been objective, and that would arguably be the conflict of
interest. Well, you know, I haven't been the only decision maker here.
I think you've made it clear that you've not looked at the evidence. We can move on.
She made a name for herself on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the rest of America got to know her better on the debate stage during her presidential run, particularly this moment from her first debate.
You know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools, and she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me.
So that was quite a moment, but her campaign eventually fizzled. She flip-flopped on health care. Her staff was disorganized. She failed to gain traction, even with black voters. She also faced criticism over her record as a prosecutor, especially from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Well, joining us to talk about Harris as Biden's pick for vice president is Avis Jones DeWeaver, senior researcher and policy advisor at Black Women's Roundtable. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it is great to have you. Was Kamala Harris your first choice?
Absolutely, she was. Absolutely.
She was.
Yes, yeah. She was.
And why was that?
Because from the beginning, to me, she exemplified excellence. She was someone who came into that race with assets that a lot of other her competitors did not have. Someone who came into the Senate having already won statewide twice before. Someone who has shown herself to be exemplary in the Senate in terms of, you showed a little snippet of it, but her work on the Intelligence and the Judiciary Committee, she actually showed up and showed out in those hearings. She was a standout in each and every one. And her record since she's been in Congress has been exemplary in terms of the types of legislation that she's attempted to get across the finish line. From the very beginning, she's shown herself to be someone who really is about the people, and that's exactly what we need in the White House.
Hmm. Well, why do you think she didn't gain more traction when she was actually a candidate? Why did her campaign fizzle?
I think there are a couple of things there. Number one, you know, there has been actually research on what happened with her campaign with regards to, in essence, coordinated attacks. Let's just be very real. Her campaign received more bot activity that looked like they have both foreign and domestic origins than any of the other presidential candidates. That started from the very beginning. And she was taking a lot of incoming that I believe were huge mischaracterizations of her record from, I would say, the far left primarily of the party. And unfortunately, her responses to those were not as forward facing as I would have hoped they would have been. I do think that when she had that moment in the first debate in which she specifically asserted herself with Vice President Biden, with that clip that you just showed, at first there was a really positive reaction to that. But then she started to get a lot of negative reaction in the media. And I think a lot of that, quite frankly, had a lot of racist and sexist overtones, like how dare this black woman say anything to this man. And I think from that, her campaign probably felt like maybe she should not be as aggressive. And I think she held herself back a little bit after that. We saw a lot of that same type of those same type of reactions, for example, when Julian Castro shown some aggression in the debates. So I would just say that I think she was held to a very different standard from the other candidates. But that said, it's not true to say that she never had traction in the Black community. I was one of the architects of a survey that the Black Women's Roundtable did in conjunction with Essence Magazine. And right towards the beginning of the race, she was from the very beginning leading among Black women, coming in second only to Joe Biden in that moment, even among young Black women. And so I do believe that oftentimes people have mischaracterized really the strengths of her campaign and only focused on the weaknesses.
But she herself acknowledged the weaknesses because she couldn't, I guess she couldn't raise the money and she had to drop out. So there were weaknesses within her campaign itself,
right. It's a
correct?
Race. There's only going to be one winner. So everybody dropped out eventually, right? Yeah. So that is the way of the game. There can only be one nominee. But when you look at what's happened right now in terms of who was selected to be the vice president candidate, you could say maybe in the broader sense that she actually finished in second place.
Right. Well, okay, well, let's talk about, you raised that moment on the debate stage where she was initially praised and then there was some blowback. And let's talk about that because a lot of people are wondering exactly how that played into Joe Biden's decision to eventually choose her, given how pointed her attack was on him for in that moment where she accused him of being anti-busing. So how do you think that will play out as they go forward in the campaign?
I honestly do believe it's water under the bridge. I think it shows a lot around Joe Biden's character that he could withstand that attack, which it was. And I don't have any problem saying that because it's a debate. I mean, that's what you do in debates. So that is, you know, what you're supposed to do. But there are some people who would have less self-confidence, less confidence in their masculinity, who might not be able to move forward beyond that. Like, for example, someone with very weak self-confidence, like Trump, would not be able to accept something like that happening. But it shows, to me, is a sign of strength to say that, hey, this was a formidable foe in the debate realm. She, in fact, got the better of me in this particular circumstance. But I see that not as something that threatens me. I see that as a quality that I will need to win in November. So this is someone who is thinking about what do I need to put together the best team possible, not only to win the election in November, but who also is going to be that my governing partner to try to fix all of those things who have been broken over the course of the past 4 years. And by both of those accounts, he selected Senator Harris, and I definitely think it was the right decision.
I wonder, I mean, you touched on this a little bit about how she was portrayed as an angry Black woman or too aggressive, and that was based in racism and sexism to some degree. And I'm wondering how she's going to have to thread that needle going forward. If Biden wants her to go out and attack Donald Trump, could that backfire with voters in the middle who might see her in that light that you just described?
Right. You're exactly right in that she will be held by a different standard. That is just a reality. However, she is someone that I believe is battle tested. She is someone that has won, as I mentioned, 3 times statewide. She ran a formidable presidential campaign, even though it was cut short. Ultimately, everybody's campaign ended except for Joe Biden's. You know, I really believe that now she is in actually a better position because now she is in this position where traditionally, right, the vice president is supposed to be the attack dog. And she has already shown herself in terms of how she has handled not only Bill Barr, how she handled Jeff Sessions, how she handled Justice Kavanaugh, that she is someone that has no problem with having very poignant and very logical and very powerful attacks. And this is exactly the type of intellect that he needs on that ticket. It's exactly the type of energy that he needs on the ticket. Because I happen to believe that the base wants a fighter. We want a fighter. It is definitely plain to see that the team that he will be going up against will do anything possible to hold on to power. We are not going to nice our way into the White House. We have to fight our way into the White House. And she is the person that is best equipped to do that.
Does it matter that some people on the left were critical of her tenure as a DA of San Francisco? I think she once called herself the state's top cop. And as her tenure as attorney general, she was not a model of progressivism when she was here. So is that going to harm her at all with younger voters, with voters on the left who might think, ugh, same old, I'm not going to turn out to vote?
Well, I would hope that they would read the recent opinion piece that was in USA Today that was published by a public defender who actually came up against her time and time again when she was the DA and a prosecutor in California, in which he specifically says that by her definition, she was a progressive prosecutor. And that was an opponent at that time who's saying that. I'm hoping that they will take a look at some of the very groundbreaking programs that she put into place when she was a prosecutor, actually some of the first diversionary programs in this country that was meant to help individuals avoid jail time and instead get the supports that they need to be able to re-enter society in a powerful way. I also hope that people would understand the history and the context of what was happening in communities at that time. And so, and all of that said, I also think it does need to be her responsibility to address these issues frontally. I never think that it's a good idea. I would never advise a candidate or anyone who is undergoing attacks to just let attacks linger, particularly when attacks are oftentimes based in misinformation. Instead, one needs to address those things frontally, provide examples of what actually happened, and move on from there. So I think that this is an issue that shouldn't be ignored. It should be addressed very directly. But I do think there's a lot of misinformation that needs to be corrected.
Right. But does she need to explain why she's changed her position on, for example, universal health care? She's now in favor of it. She wasn't before. Legalizing marijuana, same thing.
I don't remember when she wasn't in favor of universal health care. I think what the controversy was whether or not she was in favor of Medicare for all. She was always in favor of universal health care. And the issue is then how do you receive universal health care, right? So she went from being in favor of Medicare for all, which is one methodology, and then she talked to union members who told her, we have fought for the health care system that we have, for the insurance that we have, and we don't want to lose it. And that's why she changed her position in terms of providing Medicare for those who want it and for those who need it, but for those who have a health insurance plan that they like, that they can keep it. Both ways get you universal health care. So it's not actually accurate to say that she was never in favor of universal health care. She didn't change her position on that.
Okay, I misspoke. I meant to say Medicare for all, but now she is in favor of Bernie Sanders' plan, correct?
She is in favor of universal health care. And
she's not in favor of Medicare for all?
She's on a Joe Biden ticket and not on a Sanders ticket. So I would expect her to be in favor of the Joe Biden plan, which is for universal health care.
Okay, great. Well, we're going to leave it there. Of course, we will have lots more to talk about as the campaign progresses. I want to thank you so much for being with us again today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Avis Jones-DeWeaver. She is senior researcher and policy advisor at Black Women's Roundtable. Well, if Biden and Harris win in November, she'll have to give up her Senate seat. Governor Newsom would appoint someone to serve out her term, which expires in January of 2023. And the political jockeying began, about 10 seconds after Biden's announcement yesterday. With me now to talk about that is Marisa Lagos, political correspondent for KQED. She's been following Harris's career. She joins me now. Hi.
Hey, good to be here.
Great to have you. All right. So how are Californians feeling about the possibility of another California, just the second, really, to be a vice presidential candidate?
Well, with the asterisk that everybody's never happy, I would actually say I've seen a pretty overwhelming excitement and support in the Golden State, including among people who haven't always agreed with Kamala Harris. I mean, here in San Francisco, you know, we only have shades of Democrat, but they fight amongst themselves, like they're Democrats and Republicans. And a lot of people who worked with her when she was DA here who didn't always, you know, weren't always on the same page, I have seen a lot of pride, a lot of excitement. And of course, as you said, for Democrats who have their eye on a bigger prize, probably some excitement that if they win, there is going to be this open seat and the possibility for a real kind of domino effect, not just with that Senate seat, but, you know, whoever else, whoever's named to it would give up their position ostensibly and kind of going down the line.
Right. Okay, well, let's go down that line and talk about some of the some of the possibilities. And there are many, actually. And Governor Newsom would be the one to do the appointing, right? He's not going to set up a special election, so far as we know?
That's right. So as far as we know, the minute that Senator Harris exits that seat, whether it's because she's being sworn in or if she resigns before, if they win, obviously, this is all big asterisk there. But yeah, he would have be able to appoint it for the rest of her term, which runs through 2022, or, you know, the election in 2022. And he could even appoint himself.
Yeah, he could. I don't know how well that would
just
go
gonna
over
throw that out there
at this moment. But
I don't
anyway.
Think so.
All right. Well, a lot of people are floating some, you know, big names like Adam Schiff, for example. He's come up. Karen Bass, who is on Vice President on Biden's short list. Who else is on the list? Possible replacements.
Yeah, I mean, Alex Padilla, the Secretary of State, also from Los Angeles, has long been thought to really want a U.S. Senate position. I've heard even names like Lyndon Breed, the mayor of San Francisco, Eric Garcetti, the mayor of L.A., Lorena Gonzalez, assemblymember from San Diego, I've heard floated. You know, Barbara Lee, U.S. Congresswoman from Oakland. I think what, you know, in this whole question of the vice presidential, there's been a lot of conversations about demographics and sort of who is going to best represent and excite the Democratic Party. I don't think those will be the exact same conversations here, but I would certainly expect that it would weigh on this governor. I mean, Kamala Harris is one of only a handful of black women in the entire U.S. Congress, let alone Senate, right? And I think that that is historic in itself and something that he's going to be thinking of. We've never had a Latino senator from the state. So I think that there's a lot of kind of moving parts. Another name I should throw out there, Javier Becerra, our attorney general, who, of course, was picked by Newsom's predecessor to become AG out of Congress. So he's going to have a lot of people to consider and a lot of different groups who are going to want kind of him to listen to them, whether it be because of the background or that person or their policy positions.
Right. Well, also in consideration, I suppose, is the fact that Senator Feinstein is of pretty advanced age, and that could be a seat to fill in the future.
Right. And I think there's been kind of speculation over the past few years that maybe she wanted to win her reelection bid and might actually step down before the end of her term. That would be pretty extraordinary if Newsom got not one, but two picks to the U.S. Senate. I can't think of another situation like that. So I'm sure all those are going through his head. I mean, we should also talk. I was joking that I don't think our governor will step down and appoint himself. I guess he would have to appoint himself, then step down as a senator. But I do think that his political future is kind of part of the entire conversation here. He and Kamala Harris are longtime rivals to some extent, as much as they are allies. They had both thought to be eyeing the governor's office and the U.S. Senate office that she ultimately won. I think that obviously having Kamala Harris as the VP choice, if Biden wins, will put her in a much stronger position for 2024. And I think that, you know, Newsom has always had his eye on the presidency as well. So this is kind of an interesting quandary for someone like him. He's going to need to pick someone that makes at least a lot of people in the Democratic Party happy, that who could be effective. And he's probably also going to be thinking about his own political future and what it would mean for him, depending on who he picks.
Right. And he's got to look at his own political future in light of coronavirus and how he's handled the state's response, because he might have had one trajectory before COVID and he has another one now.
Yeah. And I mean, we are in a tough spot, as everybody knows. The summer has not gone well. I think there's been a lot of questions over whether he kind of bowed too soon to political pressure in terms of reopening. I mean, that all said, Madeline, you know, people's political memories can be very short. We are only, you know, what, 5-6 months into this. It does seem like, unfortunately, there's still a long road ahead. And I think that the fact that he's not on the ballot again for another few years as governor is going to make a difference in all of that. I think if we had an election coming up this fall, you might see a different calculation. But I feel like it's just so hard, right? I mean, we always say after 2016, nobody wants to make a guess, predict the future. It feels even more uncertain and difficult now, given this pandemic and sort of the broader situation that, you know, not just the nation, but the world is finding itself in right now.
Right. There have been some calls, real quick, Marisa, to have a special election. Is that going anywhere?
I wouldn't expect it. I mean, you know, I think if there was a big kind of sea change and pushing for Newsom to do that, we might see that. But I think Newsom's going to be pretty happy to be able to make that choice. I think a lot of those calls have been from Republicans, and I don't expect this governor to listen to what they're saying.
Right. Their political power is not so strong these days.
Limited.
Yeah. Limited, yeah. Shall we say. All right. Well, Marisa, thank you so much for coming on again.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Marisa Lagos, she's KQED's political correspondent. Coming up, Kanye West is running for president. Why that may not be a joke. Next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. When it comes time to vote this fall, it might come as a surprise to see Kanye West's name next to Donald Trump's and Joe Biden's. He has mounted a sudden run for president and has petitioned to get his name listed on several ballots. Currently, he's only set to be printed on Oklahoma's ballot. Republican-connected lawyers have been assisting Kanye West with his paperwork, though, reportedly to help steer votes away from Joe Biden and to strengthen Trump's chances at re-election. Rosalind Helderman is a political investigations reporter at The Washington Post, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Well, I think most of us thought this was a joke when he announced it in July. Is it?
Well, it's a little hard to tell. You know, there's not much sign of an actual Kanye West campaign. He held one rally in South Carolina, which people might have seen, where he appeared on stage in a bulletproof vest and spoke very erratically, ultimately broke down in tears on the stage. And that was part of a series of events that led to his wife, Kim Kardashian West, putting out public messages, noting his struggles with bipolar disorder and asking for the public's compassion and empathy. So there's not much of an actual West campaign, and yet we have seen these strange efforts to get him on the ballot in various states, most notably in Wisconsin and Ohio, key swing states.
With his cooperation, or are these efforts being done independently of him?
You know, it's really actually quite difficult to tell. I set out to try to track some of these efforts, and I ultimately found signs of Republican strategists, operatives, lawyers, activists, some of whom have publicly and recently supported Donald Trump. I found signs of folks like that involved with these efforts in at least five states. I tried to get someone, you know, close to Mr. West, his campaign, to talk about this. And I couldn't get anyone to respond. He did exchange text messages, Kanye himself, with a reporter for Forbes magazine last week. But I can't say that his responses were incredibly illuminating. I think he was asked about this and he responded something about how he's not running for the presidency, he's walking for the presidency. So take from that what you will.
Right. And he says his party is the birthday party. So,
yes, he's running as an independent candidate from the well-known political party, the birthday party.
Does he even have a campaign staff to call? I mean, who's running?
Yeah, I mean, that's also very hard to tell. He does have a website. For a long time, the website remained unchanged. It was one page asking you to sign a petition to get him on the ballot in South Carolina. That was true long after the deadline for getting on the ballot in South Carolina has passed. He's not going to be on the ballot in South Carolina. Just this weekend, his website was updated by someone, and now it includes sort of a 10-point policy platform that describes what he stands for, and it includes criminal justice reform, which is an issue that both he and his famous wife have worked on, as well as returning prayer to school and a few other, you know, legitimate issues. But, you know, at some point he's going to have to file a campaign finance report with the FEC. And so then we may learn a little bit more, you know, whether anyone is giving money to his campaign and then who he is paying to act on his behalf. But in the meantime, what we really see are these petition efforts to get him on the ballot. And those have all the hallmarks of being essentially run by Republican operatives.
So how seriously should the voters be taking this? Because okay, maybe he's not taking it that seriously if he's calling his party the birthday party. But if there are real efforts to get him on the ballot in swing states, as you mentioned, Wisconsin and Ohio, is there a distinct possibility that he could siphon away enough votes from, well, either Trump or Biden, but presumably from Biden?
Yeah, I mean, we have to take this one step at a time. He tried to get on the ballot in Illinois, and state officials in Illinois just announced that a large number of his signatures are invalid. And so it looks like he's not going to be on the ballot in Illinois. Ohio and Wisconsin still need to examine his petitions. And in Wisconsin, I think Wisconsin is the place where there's maybe the greatest concern amongst Democrats, given that, you know, Trump beat Hillary Clinton in that state by less than 23,000 votes, which is really not very many. And for a Democrat running for office, Black voters, you know, in the Milwaukee area and other Black voters are especially important. So there is this fear that the whole goal here is to give Black voters who do not want to support Donald Trump but are maybe not crazy about Joe Biden an alternative, and maybe they'll just vote for Kanye West. And if enough do that in a very close election, it could swing things. There's a very active challenge going on to the petitions that West filed in Wisconsin. So we're going to have to see first whether or not he actually appears on the ballot. We should know more about that probably by the end of the month.
There has been some word that some of these petitions might be fraudulent, right? That maybe the same person signed multiple signatures. There was a Mickey Mouse in one of them?
Yeah. So part of the challenges that were filed in Wisconsin noted that there were various problems. Yes, there was a Mickey Mouse. Yes, there was a Bernie Sanders. Yes, there was a Kanye West himself. Presumably those signatures will definitely be thrown out. They also argued that the form was actually filed 14 seconds late. So that's an issue that they're going to have to debate. And maybe most disturbingly, one of the challenges included a whole series of sworn affidavits from people whose names appear on the petition, who said that they swore that they were lied to before signing that petition. They were never told it was intended to get Kanye West on the ballot. They were told various other things. So I believe that the petition came in with approaching 2,500 signatures. You need at least 2,000. So if a large number of them are thrown out by the Wisconsin Election Commission, he will not appear on the ballot. His campaign did actually respond, or a lawyer who said he was acting on behalf of his campaign filed a response yesterday and tried to reject a variety of those claims and said that the Democratic Party is trying to silence Kanye West and his voice. So that's going to be an issue for state election regulators to decide in Wisconsin.
Rosalind Helderman, political investigations reporter at The Washington Post. Rosalind, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, how the pandemic is causing a coin shortage.
Yesterday, Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, even tweeted, if you have coins sitting at home, please go out and purchase things with them. We need to get these coins moving.
That story next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, we all remember when toilet paper couldn't be found anywhere. Last week, we talked about how outdoor camping equipment has become scarce now. Well, the coronavirus pandemic has created another shortage, and it sounds pretty odd. That shortage is coins. We're going to talk about that now with Kelly Ann Smith. She writes about personal finance for Forbes Advisor. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. There's really a coin shortage. Is that true?
Well, I think we have to be very careful with the way we describe what's going on. So a lot of people have been saying there's a coin shortage, but really what's going on is there's been a disruption in how the coins are circulating through the economy. The Federal Reserve came out and said, we have an adequate supply of coins. They're just not circulating as they did pre-pandemic. And if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. So when the pandemic really began here, a lot of, you know, local economies essentially shut down. Businesses, you know, were closed, people were staying at home. And so the exchange of cash, including coins, dropped significantly. And so that's why we're starting to see the consequences of that. It's just taking longer for the coins to exchange hands throughout the economy now. There isn't necessarily a coin shortage.
Right, because people aren't going to stores, so they're not spending money. They're shopping online a lot of the times. But when they do go out and they do go to stores or any other place where they need to spend money, what happens? Do they just use debit cards? They're not using cash?
Well, a lot of these businesses are requesting people to pay either an exact change if they have it. And, you know, that can be tricky. And then if you don't have exact change, then yeah, a lot of them are saying credit or debit transactions. And I think one thing that's pretty concerning to talk about is that small businesses, they can be severely affected by this, especially because even pre-pandemic, they were struggling with, you know, swipe fees or interchange fees. And that's the fee that they pay to a processor every time there is a credit or a debit transaction. So that's why you are seeing businesses request exact change, hopefully. It would definitely be better to pay with exact change if you can, especially at a small business, because you can start to see those interchange fees start to add up for them and kind of cut into their profits.
When you're talking about swipe fees, like how much does, let's say, a coffee store owner have to pay for a swipe on a latte? Let's say it's a $2 latte. How much would the swipe fee cost them?
I don't know exactly for each business. I think it's different for every business because there's so many different processors out there. But I do know that in 2018, swipe fees accounted for $64 billion in payments from merchants to credit card companies. So like I said, it can just really start to add up. But when you start taking the percentage off of those smaller sales, like maybe a cup of coffee, you know, because people don't have the option to pay in cash and they are forced essentially to pay with a card, that's when it becomes concerning for the small business, especially because I think it's safe to assume their profits might have already been hurt due to the pandemic. Now this is just an extra blow, so to say, on top of that.
Mm. And people don't want to use change or cash, I guess, because they don't want to touch it and they don't want to touch someone else's hand, or I don't know. They just feel like it could be contaminated in some way with the virus. Is that the issue?
I think that maybe at the beginning of the pandemic, when everything happened, we didn't have enough information. We didn't know enough about the coronavirus to really make those judgments. And so I think people were taking as many precautions as possible. And it's definitely one of those precautions could have been, you know, to not use cash as much.
Right. And so people are hoarding their coins at home. And what does that mean for the overall economy? Is it a problem if people don't use coins in a larger, more macro sense?
Well, when there's a circulation disruption, we're seeing that, you know, those businesses, like I said, you know, laundromats, car washes, those are key components in getting coins back to banks, which then redistribute them back into the economy. So the Federal Reserve is aware of the issue. They haven't said, you know, this is going to affect the economy, like no one should be panicking over it, but they're really just trying to encourage people to go out and to actually spend the coins. I think a good way to think about it is that people probably have a lot of their coins just sitting on the kitchen counter now, you know, maybe in a jar or something. And so they've started some initiatives to try and encourage people to go out and, you know, spend their coins or maybe exchange them at the bank for cash. Yesterday, Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, even tweeted, like, if you have coins sitting at home, please go out and purchase things with them or deposit them at the bank to exchange them for cash. Like, we need to get these coins moving. I wouldn't necessarily say that this is something that's threatening to the economy. But like I mentioned earlier, it can start to be an issue for small businesses and for other demographics, like the unbanked or the underbanked, which are people who don't have access to a bank account. So they don't have, you know, a credit card or a debit card. And so that puts them in a situation where they might have to go and explore alternative financial products that might not be in their best interest. You know, maybe they have to go and use a prepaid debit card, which they're convenient, but they're expensive. And so you start to put people in positions where, you know, they might have to pay money to use their money. And I think that's the concern here. We need to keep those people at the forefront of the conversation and make sure that we all do our part to get the coins circulating throughout the economy again.
Could it get to the point where coins are worth more than they're worth? In other words, people would pay more than a nickel to get a nickel?
I think that's a great question. I think something that's interesting about coins that's somewhat related is that it's actually more expensive to make certain coins than they're actually worth. And so that's just another thing to think about. It's not like we can go and make more coins and push them back into the economy. I mean, there's also, you know, ripple effects of that. So that's just another interesting thing to consider when we discuss this topic.
Meanwhile, we should all dig deep in our pockets and spend our coins.
Yes, get those coins moving, especially, you know, if you go down to your favorite local coffee shop, try and pay an exact change because it will definitely help them in the long run.
Kellyanne Smith, she writes about personal finance for Forbes Advisor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, how a Guatemalan director reimagined the Latin folktale of La Llorona to tell the story of indigenous genocide in his country. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Latin American folktale of La Llorona has been around for centuries. There are lots of versions, but roughly the story goes like this. A woman, enraged by her husband having an affair with another woman, drowns her two children. She immediately regrets it and then roams the land for all eternity, wailing for her children. La Llorona means the weeping woman. Usually wearing a flowing white robe, she's been a haunting figure in lots of scary stories and movies. The latest from Guatemalan director Jairo Bustamante. But his version has a political twist. It's a fictionalized account of a real genocide in Guatemala that took place in the 1980s. The film begins with the trial decades later of the retired general who allegedly orchestrated the genocide. He's found guilty, but his sentence is annulled because of his bad health. He and his family hole up in their palatial home, which is surrounded by angry protesters. The house staff, all the maids, they flee. With the arrival of one mysterious new maid wearing a white flowing dress, the chaos outside the general's mansion takes on a supernatural form inside. La Llorona is available on Shudder, and director Jairo Bustamante joins me now from Guatemala. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Synopsis of the film.
It was quite a synopsis. Well, let's talk about the myth, La Llorona. And did you grow up with that in Guatemala, that myth?
Yeah, you know, La Llorona in Mesoamerica and in some other countries of Latin America is a very, very important legend. And we really love it. And when I grew up and I realized that La Llorona doesn't exist, I started asking to me why we love it so much if, in fact, La Llorona is not a very nice story if we understand it like it's a mythology full of moral norms to control women. And in the end, it's a very, very misogynistic myth. And I decided to transform it. And I was thinking about the fact that maybe La Llorona can cry because all a whole people suffering because of genocide. And I decided to make La Llorona less a victim and more a justiciar.
So that's interesting that for a long time, the myth was seen as a way to control women. But why? Because she seems to be have a lot of power, and she has a lot of power to scare people, right? I mean, don't mothers use La Llorona to scare their children into not staying out all night because they might come across La Llorona and, I don't know, she might drown them or something? Like, isn't she seen as a powerful figure, not a weak figure?
That is an one thing and one power that she has that I wanted to keep in my film. Normally, when you're a child, adult people told you, if you make something wrong, La Llorona will know it and she will haunt you. So in a way, if you are a sinner, La Llorona know that. And La Llorona come to look for the sinner people. And I wanted to keep it in the film because I think that is a very, very nice thing.
So, as I said in the introduction, your movie is based in part on real events, and the film's general in your movie, this old guy, he's based on a real military leader. Can you tell us about that real story and how you understood it growing up in Guatemala?
In Guatemala, we suffer a very, very long military war and a genocide against Mayan people. It was horrible, but the more horrific thing at the present is that people in Guatemala still denying all that facts, and people don't want to talk about that, and people want to silence that. So to me, it was important to use La Llorona too, because La Llorona is a kind of a ghost who is against silence because she's crying. And it was important to have this feminine voice doing that, because until now there's still a lot of women in Guatemala looking for their justice, crying for that. When you live in a country like mine that people don't want to talk about the recent history, and they don't want to talk about that because they don't want to be responsible about that.
Well, I wonder if the audience in Guatemala understands it in a different way than the audience here in the United States, because we didn't grow up with that myth. So for us, it might be something different. And we also, most of us don't know the history of Guatemala.
But I think if we are empathic with other human beings, we can understand, even if we don't know the might or we don't know the recent history of that country. I think people can feel, and people can feel empathy about my characters.
What is also interesting is how subtly the wife of the general begins to shift in her understanding of her husband and what happened. Initially, she's very supportive of him and defensive of him and is very angry at the protesters. But then as the movie progresses, she slowly starts to peel back the layers and understand for herself exactly what he's been accused of and what the crimes that he allegedly committed. Can you talk about the role of the wife?
Yeah, it's a very, very important character. And I didn't want to base that character in the real Guatemalan political figure, but I wanted to understand how that kind of people can continue living and they can continue declare themselves heroes. So I'm just use all the Latin American dictators and I build the characters putting all these dictators in the same bowl. And I discovered that they are very similar. They are all acting in the same way. Like if there is an university to go and become a dictator. And it's like if there is a university to become a wife of a dictator too. And in a way, it's this phallocratic world who is forming that women to be a tool for them. So the element that we are looking for in the film is La Llorona came in that house and changed that rules. And like a woman, she used other women like a tool to add in the same movement, in a more justice movement. But there is a problem with this kind of generation because they lost all empathy and they are so selfish that they really need have this kind of divinities taking all the control of their body to make that kind of dramatic change. Mm.
Well, also, it's not just an age difference between the wife and La Llorona, because she's very young, Alma, the maid. But it's also a class difference, right? I mean, the wife is from the upper class, and Alma, the maid, La Llorona, she's indigenous. And therein is the tension in Guatemala, right? Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I was struck by how really rigid it seemed, the difference between the upper classes and the indigenous people.
I grew up in a country where discrimination is so important. And that is very, very sad because Mayan people, for example, in Guatemala, they are the majority. So we don't have problems about minorities. We have problems about majorities. And we didn't understood that our heritage come from a very, very important civilization that are Mayans. And that idea coming after the colonization, that white people are the aspiration and we have to be white, to be beautiful and to be powerful and all that, is really affecting my country. And I wanted to show it in La Llorona too, because more than 80% of the population in Guatemala, they are poor, they don't have access to education or medical services or any other kind of service. And we don't have that hope that things will change very quick. So I think art and movies have to push a little bit and continue to put it in our face, even if people here don't want to watch it.
What's been the reaction there in Guatemala?
Complicated, because people don't want to talk about that. So they don't like my work.
I see. So La Llorona, Alma, the maid, she doesn't really talk in your movie. She only communicates really with the young daughter, the general's granddaughter. Mm-hmm. Why does she do that? Why can she only communicate with her, or chooses to have a relationship with her?
I wanted to build a very elegant character, you know, not like the other weeping women that we watch in other films, that they are all the time with this kind of horrific faces. Mm-hmm. And I was more based in a kind of a ghost or a monster, if you want to tell, I use that term. More like a Dracula with that kind of elegance. And mm-hmm. based to the real legend, normally La Llorona, she just scared people weeping. So I decided to continue respecting that and give her less actions and just give her this action coming from the inside. It was a very, very complicated role for Maria Mercedes, who is the actress. And after that, In the relationship with the daughter, with the little girl, I think if there is a hope in our societies who are not respecting human rights until now, the hope is in new generations. So I wanted to try to pass that message in the film. Maybe I'm just passing a responsibility to that generation, but sorry for them.
Well, hopefully they'll take up the mantle and do something about it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for your time and for supporting our art.
My pleasure. Jairo Bustamante, he's the director of La Llorona, which is out now on Shudder. And that's it for us here on Press Play. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.